This is the Takeaway Podcast for Friday, July 17th. This is the Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And think about this week. You're on a Friday with much to consider heading into the summer weekend. I'm just speaking personally now, but I thought the last 24 hours have been something like a snapshot collage of the American psyche and the way, actually the ways, we think about crime and how that has all changed since the 1970s. Yesterday, there was the murder of four Marines in Chattanooga by a gunman born in Kuwait. We'll go to Tennessee in just a few minutes to talk about that. But also yesterday, we had the historic picture of President Obama speaking from inside a federal prison about sentencing reform.
Primary driver of this mass incarceration phenomenon is our drug laws, our mandatory minimum sentencing around drug laws. And you know, we have to consider whether this is the smartest way for us to both control crime and rehabilitate individuals.
Can you imagine such a thing back in the 1980s? A president speaking about reform from inside a federal prison? This is how the war on drugs was described by President Ronald Reagan back in 1986 as an all-out global threat to national security.
To send alarm signals across the nation. To our friends in foreign countries, we know many of you are involved in this battle with us. We need your success as well as ours. When we all come together, united, striving for this cause, then those who are killing America and terrorizing it with slow but sure chemical destruction will see that they are up against the mightiest force for good that we know. Then they will have no dark alleyways to hide in.
Back in the days of three strikes and you're out, zero tolerance and the like, you'd be more likely to see a president visit an execution, okay, that's too extreme, or a sentencing than actually visit a federal prison. But not so outrageous when you recall how candidate Bill Clinton interrupted his campaign to refuse clemency as Arkansas governor to make sure that a brain-injured man, Ricky Ray Rector, was put to death so he wouldn't be seen as soft on crime in 1992. Clinton wasn't going to make the same political mistake that Michael Dukakis did in the 1988 presidential campaign when he was assailed by this attack ad.
As governor, Michael Dukakis vetoed mandatory sentences for drug dealers. He vetoed the death penalty. His revolving door prison policy gave weekend furloughs to first-degree murderers not eligible for parole. While out, many committed other crimes like kidnapping and rape, and many are still at large. Now Michael Dukakis says he wants to do for America what he's done for Massachusetts. America can't afford that risk.
But it's clear what America really couldn't afford were the policies that have led to mass incarceration. President Bill Clinton had some regrets this week as he stood before the NAACP National Convention and admitted that his 1994 crime bill locked up too many low-level offenders who didn't deserve the sentences they were dealt.
I signed a bill that made the problem worse, and I want to admit it. And most of these people are in prison under state law, but the federal law set a trend. And that was overdone. We were wrong about that.
Jason Hernandez from McKinney, Texas, was one of those offenders who was swept up in this trend, as Clinton put it. Hernandez was sentenced to life without parole in 1998 on a first offense, crack cocaine and methamphetamine charge. The new trend is sentencing reform, and President Obama has been aggressive in commuting sentences of nonviolent drug offenders. He commuted Jason's sentence in December of 2013. And until the president acted, for 17 years, the justice system had given Jason only one message.
It kind of just showed me that there was no hope for redemption, that basically that my crime was so atrocious that I could never be trusted in society again. And there for a while when I was in prison, I kind of believed that because the prison I was in initially, which was a Beaumont USP, you know, there's nothing but murderers, rapists and terrorists and gang members there. And I kind of believed that. But over-educating myself and just seeing, running into people that were, everybody who had a life sentence were minorities. And I read a book called The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander. And it just kind of awakened me. And I started noticing the racial disparities and how my life kind of went wrong. The justice system, it just kind of threw away the key on me. And luckily, I didn't throw the key on myself, and nor did the president.
And let's talk a little bit about what it feels like to have the key thrown away. I mean, back in the 1980s, the president talked about drug offenders as a threat to national security. You were no different than Al-Qaeda back in the 1980s. And so by the time we get to your sentence, everyone in America believed you were destroying America. That was your crime, right?
Yeah, that was my crime. And I'll be honest with you. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and lie. And it's just like I told the president in the letter that I wrote him and that I tell everybody, my crime was serious. I mean, and everybody says, you know what? You didn't kill nobody. You didn't rape nobody. And I'll be quick to tell them I was a drug dealer, and a drug dealer is a terrible criminal. I mean, you're not only selling drugs, you're selling drugs to the people that you grew up with, your family, your friends, and you're doing it in the community that you were born and raised in. And that's what I was doing. And I'm not going to lie. I deserve to go to prison and deserve to go to prison for a very long time. You know, that I deserve life without parole, a sentence that would result in my death in there. To lock up a criminal, a first-time offender, nonviolent offender at the age that I was, just doesn't make sense. It sends the wrong message. And obviously we know that now because, you know, I come out of prison and there's drugs everywhere. I think the war on drugs, which I kind of refer to as the war on minorities, has increased drug use, has increased people in low-income communities to sell drugs. I mean, when you take somebody's father from them for not only a year or a couple of months, but for 10 years, a decade, or the rest of their lives, I mean, what do you think that kid's going to do growing up in that environment that his father did? I mean, it's just almost like it is the school to prison pipeline. Yeah, we've lost the war on drugs. There is no doubt about that. I mean, and just like President Obama stated, instead of building high tech prisons and hiring more guards, build better schools, double the wages for teachers, more programs, after school programs for at risk minority kids.
Think back 17 years. What would have intervened in your life to have made you make some different choices?
More positive role models in my community. I mean, there's no doctors, no teachers, no lawyers where I grow up at. When I look on TV, I don't see people that look like me, that talk like me, are playing roles of an officer, of a judge. Usually the person that looks like me in a TV show or on a movie is going to prison. He's selling drugs. He's using drugs. And for people who think that that doesn't have an impact on a kid whose brain is not fully developed, you know, they're absurd. When a person commits a tragic crime, 9 times out of 10, they connect it to a video game. But yet, when a person is actually living this video game, they don't make the connection. They just automatically assume he's a bad person. They don't look at what created that circumstance and what made him do them acts.
Can you tick off for me just a couple of things that happened in the world, in your family, while you were in prison?
I watched about six to seven of my family members pass away, aunts, uncles, cousins. My son, who was 7 months old when I was arrested, grew up without me. When I was released, he was from seven. He went to 17 years. There's a lot. I just can't even really. Nobody has asked me that question. But
so let's say a year from now, you're in a tough position. You know, you've got some of these struggles, and you know, you're not feeling as upbeat maybe as you are right now, and you're feeling a little angry, and you know, maybe you wish you had some place to turn. If you could talk to President Obama, what would you tell him during your worst moment, where you feel like, man, this is really hard?
Well, to be honest, John, I just don't think that there could be anything that can amount to waking up every day in prison, going to sleep, knowing that I was going to die in prison. But there are individuals who will probably get out here and will encounter very, very, you know, difficult situations. And I will, too. I mean, I've encountered them. But, you know, if I could tell the president anything about the war on drugs and sentencing reform, is to just keep pushing Congress, keep informing society on what's going on with the war on drugs, how it has been misled, and to not let every inmate go, because that's just impossible. But those that are serving unconstitutional, racially biased sentences that have proved while incarcerated that they have changed, to give them a second chance at life. I mean, that's, you know, basically what America is based on, you know, giving people the opportunity. And like I said, not everybody has earned it, but those who have, you know, send them back to their mothers, to their fathers, and to their children.
What do you say to your son?
I tell him I'm sorry for being ignorant and being stupid, basically. My greed led to him being raised without a father. And, you know, our bond isn't close. I mean, he doesn't call me dad or father. You know, I'm not mad at him. It's like I said, it's my fault. And it's something that I have to work on. And, you know, I'll start off as his friend. And eventually, I think our bond will be stronger than it could possibly be. It's just something that one of the effects of being in prison for nearly two decades has. But, I mean, it's something I have to live with. And I got to make the most out of it. And I'll make the best out of it.
Jason, it's been great talking to you. I just have one more question now. Just imagine that I'm sitting at a desk and I'm one of those sort of officials who has all the rules. And, you know, I'm a law-abiding American, okay, Jason? And I got a family and I've played by the rules and I pay my taxes, Jason. And all of a sudden, here I am faced with this guy who spent 17 years in prison, who threw his life away on drugs. Jason Hernandez, what do you want?
What do I want? I just want to be looked at as every other normal citizen looks at. I mean, I know I committed a crime and I paid for it. I think I paid severely for it. And I just wanted a chance at life just to get a job, which I have a job. But, you know, people don't judge me on what I've done on the past, but more on what I'm capable of doing in the future. And I know it's going to take everything for me to prove the naysayers wrong. But all I ask is just for an opportunity to do that. Just give me that chance. And that's all I ask for.
Jason, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you too. God bless you.
Jason Hernandez was sentenced to life without parole for selling methamphetamine and crack cocaine in 1998. President Obama commuted his sentence in December of 2013. Just a few hours after speaking from inside a federal prison, President Obama was back in the Oval Office expressing condolences for the latest victims of gun violence in the United States, four Marines killed in a shooting in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
You know, we take all shootings very seriously. Obviously, when you have an attack on a U.S. military facility, then we have to make sure that we have all the information necessary to make an assessment in terms of how this attack took place and what further precautions we can take in the future. And as we have more information, we'll let the public know. But in the meantime, I'd ask all Americans to pray for the families who are grief-stricken at this point. And I want everybody to understand that we will be thorough and prompt in figuring out exactly what happened.
And there are still many questions, but the grief in this Tennessee community is deep and certain. Here's Chattanooga Mayor Andy Burke.
Today is a nightmare for the city of Chattanooga. Around 11 o'clock this morning, we had someone viciously attack at two different locations people who proudly serve our country.
Rabbit Zilke is a reporter for WUTC Public Radio in Chattanooga. She says grief is about the only thing that is clear at this point for the people of this community.
There were so many vigils last night at different churches, synagogues, all across the city. Even the local leaders at the mosque and the Muslim leaders are shocked and outraged at what happened, because you just don't expect something like this. And I won't say a sleepy town, but we're a mid-sized town, really big on outdoor sports and recreation. You certainly wouldn't think that something like this could happen here.
The alleged shooter, 24-year-old Mohammed Yusuf Abdulaziz, who died in the incident, was known in the community and had a good reputation. But here's a detail. The Chattanooga Times Free Press reported that in his graduating yearbook, Abdulaziz was quoted as saying, "My name causes national security alerts. What does yours do?" Richard Fawcett is in Chattanooga. He's national correspondent for the New York Times. I asked him if this is any hint that Abdulaziz might have found himself on a path toward radicalization.
John, that's a great question. That's exactly what the FBI and other authorities are looking into right now. We were told yesterday evening, late, by the FBI that thus far they have nothing that connects Mr. Abdulaziz to international terrorist organizations, but they also noted that they are very much in the preliminary stages of their work here.
What was he like? What role in the community did he have? What have you managed to learn?
Well, by all accounts, we're getting a portrait of a young man who was well-adjusted, who was well-liked, who came from a very well-respected family who lived in Hickson, Tennessee, just across the Tennessee River from Chattanooga, in an upper-middle-class suburb. The people who lived around them, many of them white and Christian, were very accepting of this family, despite the fact that they were Muslims who wore headscarves. And I say despite the fact because in the state of Tennessee in the past, especially in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, there have been tensions between Muslims and non-Muslims over the construction of mosques and such. The young man was a wrestler at his high school. Later, he was a mixed martial artist. And from our accounts and the accounts of other news organizations here, people really generally until yesterday had only good things to say about him and his character and his family's character.
And the thing that's so frustrating about this is that, you know, the FBI talks a lot about lone wolf terrorist activity. ISIS is even encouraging lone wolves to act. But yet the pathway of radicalization is unclear. I mean, this there's no clear narrative for how you go from being just someone in the community to being someone who's angry enough to do something like this. And that's still a mystery even here in Chattanooga.
It is. And, you know, it reminds me in a way of the case of the alleged shooter in the Charleston massacre. In both cases, in that case, there are some indications that the alleged shooter in that case was prompted to do what he did and inspired by hardcore white supremacist ideology that he found on the internet. If that is indeed the case, and if it's the case that Mr. Abdulaziz was inspired by and radicalized by messages he found on the internet, and thus far we do not know if that is the case. But if that turns out to be the case, it is a huge conundrum for law enforcement. How do you stop people from being inspired by bad ideas? My guess is that there's no way to stop that at all.
Richard Fossett, national correspondent for The New York Times, on the line from Chattanooga. Thanks so much, Richard.
Thanks, John.
An incident in New York a year ago showed once again how misguided notions of what constitutes crime and exactly who is a dangerous criminal can be fatal.
I can't breathe. I can't breathe.
The last words of Eric Garner, whose only crime was selling cigarettes on the streets of Staten Island in New York City, killed after a police chokehold. Garner's death and the decision not to indict the police officers who watched him die posed a national question. Who is a criminal? Are citizens the enemy? Who should be punished and how?
I can't breathe! I can't breathe! I can't breathe!
Protesters in New York City shouting words that became a rallying cry across the nation. Is the nation changing or dividing into armed camps over the question of what constitutes appropriate law enforcement? Jamie Floyd, legal analyst for our co-producer WNYC, says it will take quite some time for anger and defensiveness here in New York to give way to deeper systemic change and reform.
Well, a year is not a very long time.
Right.
And I think they're still feeling the shock waves of it all. It was also public, of course, and on videotape, or digital, if you will. I think a lot of it has been in political activism. Eric Garner's mother has been politically active, pushing the city council for reform, pushing the governor for reform, and the community has responded in the same way. And some of those reforms have happened, some have not. But I think until there is some measure of justice in the eyes of the community, there will be a continued push to see some change in a real sense, some active and actual policy change in our city.
So the $5.9 million settlement is just a very first step.
For the family, at least, and for that community, has been about money. Certainly, it's helpful. But the family said from the very beginning, this is not about money. And there was not an indictment against any of the officers. So they're going to continue to push the federal government to do something to recognize the death of Eric Garner. And there can also be disciplinary action within the department. That's happened in some of the other high-profile cases in New York City, where there were not indictments, but there was disciplinary action within the department. So I think they're hoping to see some action that makes more of a statement than the $5.9 million.
What about the question of tension between law enforcement and, you know, the mayor, for that matter, tension between law enforcement and the community? There was really fiery rhetoric from the police union in the beginning, in the aftermath of Eric Garner and what happened after that. That's come down? That's softened?
Well, we had the deaths of two police officers in the wake of Eric Garner's death. And then we also had the death of another young man, Akai Gurley. So, no, the tension has not really diminished. But there have been some changes in some of the policies that give one cause for hope. So, for example, before Eric Garner died, the stop and frisk policy has been reviewed and eliminated. And we seem to forget that because we have since had these deaths. Both the young men died and the police officers died. And that ratcheted up the tension, even as stop and frisk is not happening anymore. And police officers are being trained in new ways to engage with the public within the bounds of the Constitution and without bias. So while the rhetoric and the tension is there, I think if we were to look at what's happening within the force, and this is a force of 35 and soon to be 36,000 officers, so change is going to be slow, we might see some cause for hope.
So those changes may come as new officers join the force, and that culture will be seen, you know, down the road.
But slowly.
How would you rank the mayor as someone who is forced into a position of being a mediator here, of being a bridge builder? And I think in communities around the country, when these kinds of incidents have happened, people in the community always turn to political leadership to try to help and move forward. How has the mayor done here?
Well, the mayor came on at what could have been a time of transformational leadership for a mayor in a city that was poised for great change. But then, of course, Eric Garner was killed. He didn't just die. He was killed on Staten Island. The level of culpability has still not been ascertained or adjudicated, if you will. And he was placed really between a rock and a hard place. He stood by his police commissioner, who in turn had to stand by his officers. And so the mayor has not been that transformational leader. At the same time, we have to ask ourselves, are we better off in this city than we were 2 years ago or 10 years ago in terms of the relationship between police officers and the communities they serve? I think the mayor is receiving relatively low marks from the very people who elected him to deal with these issues. Time will tell.
Looking around the country at places and communities where this has been a problem and it's openly resulted in tension in the streets, and New York is one of those communities, we have two scenarios, apparently. We have a scenario where there's a complete sort of reorganization of the police department, a complete rethinking of the characters who are involved, and that's what's going on in Ferguson. But then you've got here in New York where the scenario seems to be a division, a kind of a, the police are over here and the community is over here. And I would say, is that division going to stand here in New York that you've described?
Well, in smaller places like Ferguson and several police departments adjoining Ferguson, you can completely tear down a police department and build it back up. You're talking about fewer than 100 officers. It's really, and we didn't understand this watching the images on television, it's a tiny place. Here we're talking about a force of thousands. It's the largest police department in the country by a long shot. I mean, even Los Angeles has fewer than 10,000 police officers. You can't break this down and build it back up. It has to evolve. It has to change. There has to be a change in culture and mindset in this police force. I think we can make the changes we need to make here with the leadership we have. But we do have to think differently about policing. It can't be militarized. It has to be truly community-based policing. And I know it's becoming a cliche, but that's what works, policing with the community and in the communities and walking the communities, not driving around in your patrol car. And that is the model they've moved to now. I talked about stop and frisk having been eliminated. The next thing they're doing, and they've started to implement this in New York, is back to community policing. So I think these changes are slow in coming, but they are coming, and we have to hope that there will be change over time. It doesn't come overnight.
A year after the death of Eric Garner, Jamie Floyd, WNYC legal analyst, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And here's something to take with you today. Thoughts about how much has changed in our notions of race, crime, and justice in America over the past two decades, or how little has changed.
Hi, this is Corey from Cape Cod, Mass. And I want to say, you know, it's been really sad. The race relations between families of color and whites has really dropped off. You know, I haven't felt this divide since the O.J. trial and the verdict.
From LaGrange, Illinois, I've seen black and white Chicago police officers walking a beat together. Lived here for 60 years and never saw that before. That's all for today. I'm John Hockenberry. Have a great weekend. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com. Citrix, creator of GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring a personalized meeting room for a custom look. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
NYC Now delivers breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. By sponsoring our programming, you'll reach a community of passionate listeners in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to learn more.